supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Just a bunch of states that were under a federation, you know, but still you were a Pennsylvanian, you were a Virginian. There wasn't this American idea. You were just from these states.
Case in point, the Star Spangled Banner was written during the War of 1812, although it took another 120 years for it to be adopted as the national anthem. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
In sports, the South Florida Bulls beat Temple last night, 58-44. Lehigh knocked Duke out of it, 75-70. This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Many, many, many of you have been asking about how the warm weather you've experienced this winter affects your timing on many issues, especially applying corn gluten to prevent dormant crabgrass seeds from sprouting. We'll have the expert answer for you towards the end of the show. In the meantime, though, lots of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Carla, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just fine. Carla, how are you?
Well, I'm good, except we have a problem.
Oh, where are you?
I am in Columbus, Georgia.
Okay, very good. What's the problem in Columbus?
We have termites.
Oh, you poor thing.
Thank you.
Now,
can you help me?
I'll try.
Okay.
Where are your pets? Didn't you read the lease? No pets.
Yeah, I know. They are in the corner boards outside of the fireplace.
Oh, I see. Like the chimney.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, chimney. Yeah.
So, have you pried away the boards and you've seen the larvae and everything?
Yeah, they're there.
And have you had anybody who's like a termite expert inspect the place?
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, believe it or not, they're actually easy to control.
Awesome.
Without spraying anything.
Okay.
And it is such a simple solution. You remind me, I guess it was about a year ago that we had our good friend Bill Quarles on the air from the BIRC, the Biointegral Resource Center in Berkeley, California. And Bill had just done a special issue of one of his journals, Common Sense Pest Control and the IPM Practitioner. And I got him on the show because I couldn't believe it. Now, there are many ways of controlling termites. One of the ways I've always advocated is with what are called bait stations.
Uh-huh.
These are things you pound into the ground around your house.
Uh-huh.
They have flip tops. The bottoms that are pounded into the soil have openings so the termites can come and go.
Uh-huh.
And you put in wood that is treated with boric acid.
Okay.
Boric acid is a very slow-acting poison for termites and ants.
Uh-huh.
So the worker termites who have a colony near you somewhere that is enormous underground.
Ugh.
And they're going back and forth from your home to this colony. I mean, some of them are living in your wood, but most of them are outside in some gigantic colony somewhere, which is why spraying a house is ineffective, because it's, you know, there's this enormous number of workers that can just keep coming back at you.
Yeah.
So what happens is the workers can go into these termite bait stations. They nibble on the borate-treated wood. It seems fine to them. And then they start to take this material back to the nest, and they share it with the rest of the colony. Well, it takes about a week for the boric acid to work its effect on that first worker. And by the time the first worker realizes, I don't feel so good, the boric acid has gotten to every termite in the nest, including the all-important queen.
Right.
And I'm not going to try to remember off the top of my head, but I will tell you that bait stations pounded into the ground outside an infested house cleared the house of termites, I believe, over 90% of the time.
Okay.
Because you're attacking the colony. You're not attacking just these couple of termites that happen to be inside your house at any given time. And then keeping these bait stations active and filled with treated wood will protect your house in the future.
Okay.
So I want you to do two things. I want you to go to our website. I want you to go to You Bet Your Garden. Go to Garden Answers A to Z and look under T for termites. But I also want you to go to the BIRC. It's BIRC.org. And buy their special publication on termite control that came out about a year ago.
Okay.
And then you can work with a local pest control specialist. They'll see all the studies, all the research. It's not only safer than having your house sprayed, it's tremendously more effective. And the clearance rate just blew me away. It was like the best news I had heard all year.
Wow. That sounds fabulous.
And we can hear in the background one of the reasons you don't want to spray inside your house, right?
Yes, bless her heart. Yes, she is. She is one of the reasons. That's exactly right.
And that's the beautiful thing about these bait stations with borate-treated wood outside. There is no harm possible to anything that's not a wood-eating ant or a termite.
That's wonderful.
When the colony dies, they'll run out of workers, they'll stop attacking your wood, you can get the wood replaced and fixed up, and then as long as you keep those bait stations active, your house is safe forever.
Awesome. I just thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's always good to have good news.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Seth, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Seth. How are you?
I'm doing great.
And where is Seth great?
I'm in Isla Vista, California.
Okay, very good. Is that in the Santa Barbara area?
Yeah, it's the college town associated with the University of California, Santa Barbara.
What could be? I mean, it's paradise, right? It's a college town. It's in Southern California. I mean, how does it get any better than this?
It actually doesn't. I spent a lot of time going to school here.
Oh, so what, you're a fifth-year sophomore? Is that stretching it out?
Well, I did my undergraduate here, and then it took me 9 years to get my PhD.
Excellent, excellent. Why would you ever leave, right?
Exactly.
Surf's up. All right, what can we do for Seth in sunny California?
There was a caller a couple of weeks ago about overwintering pepper plants, and she used terracotta pots, and she was having trouble with them drying out.
Right.
And so I looked at my container garden and realized that my plants that are in terracotta pots are drying out. So I was wondering if there were some other uses for them.
The practicality decreases along with the humidity. But one of the problems, especially here in the Northeast, is that our indoor air is very dry in the wintertime. And as you know, terracotta wicks its moisture right out into the air. So although they're very attractive, it's almost impossible to keep them evenly watered. And you have the same situation outdoors, whereby our summers are relatively humid, and you can get away with having terracotta outside without having an overwhelming need to, like, water every day. Your problem in California is lack of moisture everywhere, pretty much, except the ocean.
Right.
So terracotta is always going to be difficult to keep watered. And then on top of that, water is one of your really limited resources. But I will tell you, Seth, there is a cheap and sleazy trick that... my favorite type of gardening, man, that will allow you to have the look of your terracotta and reduce the watering needs of your plants. And that is to slip a liner of plastic inside the terracotta where it won't be seen. Then fill the pot with your soil and your plants. The plastic will prevent the terracotta from having its osmotic effect and letting all that moisture go join the air, But you won't see it if you do it right. You'll just see the terracotta.
That's very clever.
Yeah, well, every, you know, even a broken watch is right twice a day, Seth. Every once in a while I come up with something good.
So would those be the, like, a plastic pot or those black plastic, like, flexible pots?
Well, you got some options. What I have done in the past, you can imagine I've been gardening for like 30 years, and people are always sending me plants to test and everything. I have every size plastic pot known to God and man. So I can just go down to the basement of unlimited resources and ruffle around and find the right kind of plastic pot. But you could even cut up plastic trash bags. And line the inside of the terracotta with them, as long as you remember that you need good drainage out the bottom. That is unchanged. You know, you wouldn't line the bottom, and you'd want to use a plastic pot that had holes punched in it or that was a planting pot anyway. But I would think once you realize the only thing you need to do is have the dirt invisibly contained by plastic, which retains the moisture and doesn't let it wick out into the air, then you'll probably even come up with crazier ideas or better ways to do it. But I would say that there's probably 8 ways to do it right.
Okay, great.
All right, Seth?
Yeah, thanks very much.
All right, enjoy the beautiful weather.
I shall.
All right, take care, man.
Okay, you too. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and put my first run of pre-sprouted pea seeds in the ground. Although St. Patrick's is the lucky day to plant spring peas, the soil is rarely warm enough for good germination. So I soak my seeds in moist paper towels for a couple of days before I plant them in that cold, cold ground. Because pea plants don't mind cold weather one bit. In fact, they love it. But don't you go saturating your snaps and snows just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and how warm winter weather affects the timing of seeds that sprout into weeds in your lawn. I'm Weedy Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden, made possible in part by Burpee. Burpee is a gardening resource featuring vegetables, flowers, videos, and more. The 2012 catalog is now available online at burpee.com.
This is WHYY.
Henswood Village, a Quaker-directed active senior living community, supports WHYY. Situated on 82 acres in Bucks County, Henswood Village offers residential, health, and community services designed to meet the needs of people over 65. Amenities include garden apartment living, type A all-inclusive life care, and a newly renovated community building. A green community, Penswood welcomes applications for future residency. For details or a tour, 888-454-1122 or penswood.org.
Fair skies and 57 degrees in Center City.
Supporting WHYY, the First Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia at 21st and Walnut, offering an inclusive commitment to the city and concerts throughout the year. Information at fpcphila.org or 215-567-0532.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, our email overfloweth with questions about how this warm winter many of us have experienced is going to affect the germination of warm season weed seeds like crabgrass that cause lawn owners so many headaches. We went right to the top to get the answer, and we'll bring it to you after lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Patty, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Welcome. Thank you very much. It's nice to hear from you.
Well, it's nice to hear from you, Betty. Where are you?
Yeah, I'm in Christchurch, New Zealand.
Yes, you're that, Betty. You emailed a question, I believe, about companion planting and marigolds.
That's right. That's right. I have tomatoes, and I was trying to think, how do I prevent these little creepy green caterpillars from coming in the first place? And I wondered about marigolds, and you said that French marigolds aren't actually as good as they're cracked up to be, but maybe I'm wondering about English marigolds or other things I can plant.
You know, here in the United States, it would be the tomato hornworm, a big, very large caterpillar that would prey, that would be the biggest caterpillar pests of tomato plants. So do you have a similar pest, or is it a different type of caterpillar?
Well, they're little when I've seen them and gotten rid of them, so I haven't seen them as being big.
But they chew the leaves, and sometimes they chew into the fruit.
Yes, that's what I noticed first, was that the leaves on my previously healthy plant were all turning lacy, and I thought, oh, somebody's eating these. So then I looked around, and I found these little green caterpillars munching away.
Okay, very good. Now, yeah, obviously, pesticide laws change from country to country, but typically the first thing we tell people who have caterpillars eating their plants is there's an organic pesticide that's been around for 50 years called BT. And if you spray this on a plant, and only caterpillars who eat the sprayed leaves will be harmed. It doesn't harm a butterfly who lands on the leaf. It doesn't harm birds, doesn't harm water supplies. So a lot of time, and it's been around for, as I said, like 50 years. So at least in this country, generic versions are out there. It is very inexpensive, and it is probably the safest thing in the world because, again, it only harms caterpillars who eat the sprayed leaves. If you can get BT, that's a good knockdown solution. But long-term, you're thinking correctly to invite beneficial insects into your garden to prey upon the pest caterpillars. Now, marigolds have this long folk history of repelling deer and rabbits and slugs. Exactly. Any gardener can tell you it is one of their favorite foods. You know, I guess the only hope that you'd get with marigolds is that the rabbits and deer and slugs would fill up on the marigolds and have no room left for your for your garden crops. The one thing where they actually did something in a study is they were plowed into the ground. A big field of marigolds was allowed to flower and then plowed into the ground, and it made that ground intolerable for a very notorious southern garden pest here in America called the southern root knot nematode. So everybody knows how strong marigolds smell, and that smell, the naturally occurring compounds, made the ground almost toxic for these root knot nematodes that make it very difficult to grow tomatoes and other crops in the deep south. But with your caterpillar pest, what you want to attract to your garden are teeny tiny little wasps that I'm almost certain exist in your environment as well as mine. These wasps are so small, we literally can't see them. They're the size of a period at the end of a sentence. But they lay their eggs inside pest caterpillars or otherwise prey upon pest caterpillars, and they are voracious predators. And there's three things you need to do to get these wasps and other beneficial insects to come into your garden. The first, of course, is use no chemical pesticides.
I'm organic anyhow.
Good. Well, BT is totally organically approved. There's nothing wrong with spraying BT in an organic garden, and it wouldn't harm any of these beneficial insects. The second is to grow plants with very small flowers, especially herbs, to grow a whole bunch of grow culinary herbs and grow twice as many as you need for the kitchen and allow the other half to flower. The flowers on these small herbs are the best attractors because these beneficial insects will come in for the pollen and nectar, and then they'll prey upon your pest caterpillar.
So thyme and oregano?
And basil and...
Right.
There is a marigold that does attract them. It's the lemon gem variety. But typically, marigolds have big flowers. You want plants with really small flowers because, again, these insects are so small, and they got to go in there to get the pollen and nectar. And then the third way you attract these creatures is my favorite, is really cool. You set out little dishes filled with pebbles and water. These creatures need water, but they can't drink at like a bird bath or a lake or a pond. They need to be able to perch on stones. And so you fill an old dish, an old tray with stones, and then fill it with water. And they can come and sit on the stones, get some water. That makes your garden a tremendously positive environment for them. And they're going to live somewhere. So that's the idea, is you want to bring them in to your garden. Just surround the plants that are being attacked with plants with very small pollen and nectar-producing flowers. And within a season or two, you'll have built up an incredible population of your local beneficial insects. The way you really make companion planting work is by typically surrounding big plants that get attacked by smaller flowering plants that bring in the beneficials.
Oh, that's great. Thank you very much.
All right, Betty. Well, enjoy the rest of your season over there on the other side of the world.
Thank you very much, and greetings to your listeners.
Okay. Very good. Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Rick, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Rick. How are you?
I am fine, and I am fine in Ardmore, Pennsylvania.
Very good. The man knows the drill. What can we do for Rick in Ardmore?
I have what is for you probably a simple question, but I have a long line of mature growth yew bushes. They're about waist high. They're next to the front walk to our house, and they're kind of boxing in this walk. They're not overgrown. I keep them trimmed, but what I'd like to do is trim off about the top 5 or 6 inches of these yew bushes, but that's where most of the growth is. And I'm wondering, if I do that, will I kill them?
Well, yews are typically very hardy plants. I inherited a couple of yew bushes when we bought our house, and my problem was not caring for them. My problem was, when we finally re-landscaped their area, was getting them to leave. They can be very stubborn, and I assure you the root system of your yews probably goes down several miles, if my experience was any indicator. Now, you say they're encroaching on a walkway, but you want to cut their tops. That doesn't make sense for me unless you're walking on the air.
No, they're not really growing over the walkway. The walkway is bordered by them on the left and the right, and they just have kind of created a tunnel effect. They're not in the way, but I wanted to just lower them on one side to open up the walkway a little bit visually.
Well, what I would suggest you do is wait until they begin growing again for the season, which will be shortly. And you know when this happens because you see all the random shoots kind of heading out. And
right.
Then you aren't planning on using one of those, like, electric hedge trimmers, were you?
That's probably what I was going to try to use, but I don't think that's going to work with these guys because they're so tough.
Yes, and I'm going to try to talk you out of that anyway. What I would rather see you do is get in there with a pair of pruners, a pair of loppers, you know, have good gloves, do the work slowly, you know, don't try to get it all done in one day, and just trim them back a little bit. Let's say trim them back by about a third of what you hope to accomplish.
Okay.
And then look at your work. Think about how you like your work. Have an iced tea. Give yourself a couple of days. And then if you think that they could still use another little cutting, then go back and do it again, taking off the same amount. You will always do better reshaping a shrub like this if you do it over the course of a season in small amounts. I will tell you, the slower you go, the more patient you are, the more you break the work up into sequential weeks, the better these bushes are going to look, and the better you'll understand what it's going to take for you to keep them under control. But if you play whack-a-mole, you may wind up with real bare spots and openings and things that you don't like.
All right. Well, that's good advice, Mike. I appreciate that. I was really sort of vexed as to really how to deal with these and keep the green there. So I'll give that a shot.
Exactly. When you prune, you're encouraging the plant to fill in. So even though it seems counterintuitive, over the course of a season, pruning a little bit every week or every other week, at the end of the growing season, you can have removed twice as much as you would if you had gone and given it a jarhead cut, and the plants will look twice as good. They'll be full and green and lush, and you will have reduced their size without harming that look.
Well, that's great. Well, I definitely won't give it the jarhead look.
All right.
Thanks very much, Mike. I really appreciate it.
I think you're going to do great.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, Rick.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
According to my wife, I'm better than nothing.
Well, we'll second that motion. Where are you, Tom?
I'm in southern Middle Tennessee.
All right, very good. What can we do for Tom, who I'm sure is much better than nothing?
Well, I'm wanting to do some raised bed gardens.
Good, good.
I know you suggest building them 4 feet wide as long as you want. Is it a matter of east and west or north and south?
I've really never worried so much about the orientation of my beds. I realized afterwards maybe I should have, but I just kind of built the first one, and then that kind of dictated how the others were going to go. I think what is important is that the east-facing side of the beds, that's where you want to plant things like tomatoes and roses and things that are prone to disease, because you always want them to get the first rays of the morning sun. Now, you said you're in Middle Tennessee, so your summers, you'll get a couple of blindingly hot weeks, right?
Oh, yes.
So you want to,
I'm humid.
You want to be careful with south-facing beds, any south-facing bed, because you're always building these things never in isolation. You always have structures and trees somewhere around. A bed that faces south, it would be a real mitzvah for it to get afternoon shade naturally. Because as you know, sometimes the full sun that you guys get down there in the summer is too much for some plants.
Well, I have two spots in mind. One gets pretty much full sun most of the day. It starts shading later on in the afternoon. The other one doesn't get sun until about 11 in the morning.
Excellent, excellent. Well, then the most important thing, don't plant tomatoes in the one that doesn't get sun until 11. Tomatoes want morning sun, and they would love some afternoon shade. Whereby a lot of other crops, they're fine waiting until 11. You could put peppers there. You could put squashes there. You could grow potatoes there. Tomatoes are so disease-prone that they need to dry their leaves off first thing. So in the beds that you have, and in the future, you know, you're going to have to rotate your tomatoes around. So try to make sure there's always a fresh place to put them that meets that requirement. But that's the most important thing there, is that any plants that you're having disease issues with, they get that morning sun.
Okay, well, that brings me to another question. Then I want to build some 4x4 foot bark gardens. Would that be about the best place for like bushy stuff, like tomatoes and peppers?
I have 4x4 raised beds in my garden, and I have 4x8 raised beds. I really don't use them for different purposes. You know, in a 4x4 bed, for instance, I'll put one big honkin' tomato plant in the summer. And then I'll surround that with smaller plants, maybe some nasturtiums, maybe some herbs, you know, maybe a really compact little bell pepper plant or a little hot pepper or something like that. Or buying in a 4x8 bed, I'll have two, maybe three tomato plants in there. The size of the bed really doesn't dictate the crops. More than anything is keeping in mind what kind of sun requirements the plants have, which ones are real sun hogs, which ones need the morning sun, and which ones need that afternoon shade.
Okay. One other thing. I have access to soil and a bunch of worm castings.
Oh, excellent.
Would that be about the best thing to fill them up with?
Well, what do you mean by soil? That doesn't really mean anything.
Well, I have friends in a nursery business.
Oh, and so do you mean soil-free mix, the stuff that they grow their bedding plants in?
I don't really know what they have, but I know they have an overabundance of worm castings. And
An overabundance? I'm moving down to your part of the country, Tom.
Well, they get it by the tractor-trailer load.
Oh, my goodness. If you fill those raised beds with half soil-free mix and half worm castings, call the local newspaper to get ready to come out and take pictures of you with giant vegetables at the end of the season.
Okay.
All right. Well, good luck with your raised beds, man. You got some good plans there.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind listeners who have no land of their own that now is the time to either seek out a plot in a community garden or join a CSA, a local organic farm in which you can buy a share for the season and receive a share of the produce that farm produces every week. But don't go running to our website for all the details on how to locate the community gardens and/or CSAs nearest you just yet, because we'll be right back with expert advice on when to stop crabgrass from germinating this spring. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Burpee. For over 135 years, Burpee has provided gardeners with seeds and plants for everything from tomatoes to flowers to gourmet herbs. Online at burpee.com.
It's 11:38. This is WHYY.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. The annual Buck's Beautiful Garden and Home Show continues today and tomorrow at Delaware Valley College in Doylestown. I'll appear at the Radnor Memorial Library at 7 p.m. this coming Wednesday, March 21st, to talk about growing Titanic tomatoes and provide organic answers to all your growing questions. Then I'll do three talks, tomatoes, lawn care, and composting, at the Delaware Home Show in Dover next Saturday, March 24th. And on Saturday, March 31st, the Wagner Free Institute of Science will present a lecture by the University of Akron's Dr. Hazel Barton on the ongoing crisis of white nose syndrome in bats, one of nature's best pest controllers. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
The WHYY forecast for this St. Patrick's Day, not too bad. Mostly sunny skies with a high of about 66 Sunday. Some clouds in the morning, then sun in the afternoon. Sunday's high, 68. Right now it's 59 degrees.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. How does a warm, warm winter affect the timing for preventing the germination of crabgrass and other warm season weeds that would otherwise plague your lawn all summer? We went right to the top and asked the man who discovered the properties of corn gluten to prevent weeds what the answer is. We'll tell you what he said after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Heidi, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thank you.
Well, thank you, Heidi. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
And where is Heidi fine?
I am calling from Damascus, Maryland, which is just north of Washington, D.C.
Very good. What can we do for Heidi right near our nation's capital?
I have a lemon tree, and it's a dwarf Meyer lemon tree.
Right.
And I got it as a gift in November, and it was from a mail order company, so it came to me packaged. I planted it in a nice container, probably about 3.5 feet tall, and it bloomed fabulously all through the holidays. So all through December, incredible amount of blooms. The leaves were glossy and shiny, and everything looked great. I had two small lemons that were growing on it, and then the blooming sort of stopped at the beginning of January, and I didn't know whether that was just like the regular course of how a lemon tree works. But then on close inspection, I saw that I had spider mites.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know whether that was something that I can cure, because I really like the plant, but I'm not quite sure what to do with it.
Oh, it's actually one of the easiest cures in houseplant pestum. And it tells us something about your indoor air at the same time. Your place is very dry.
Yes.
And this is a very common occurrence in the wintertime in many homes in the Northeast United States. When couples are angry at each other, they can stage a good electrical fight just by putting on a sweater and rubbing their feet on the floor and then chasing the other person around. And when you can do that, that's a sign that the indoor air is too dry for your lungs, for your mucous membranes, to be as healthy as they can. And it's also devastating on a number of plants. And for some reason, spider mites, which are not insects, they are an arachnid, they are a mite, they're not a spider, but they are eight-legged as opposed to six. When the air gets dry inside a house, these things appear just out of another dimension. You know, it almost doesn't seem to matter whether you had any spider mites around or not. They just show up somehow. And the cure for them is so simple, it's ridiculous. And the only thing you need to do is humidify the air, really only, at least if the only problem is the spider mites, right around that plant. Buying a stupid little mister at that dollar store. And misting the leaves of the plant every morning for 2 weeks, the spider mites will go back to their dimension of hatred and fear somewhere, just looking for the next dry house to invade. But that's really all it takes.
Okay, that's great news.
What kind of heat do you have?
Forced air.
You know, in a case like yours, you would rig the humidifier right up to your central heater, right?
Right.
That might be something you might want to look into. We live in an old farmhouse, and so we keep big dishes of water on the radiators all winter long to keep the air nice and moist. But I tell you, I find I often have to water my houseplants more in the winter than I tell other people to, simply because our air tends to be a little bit dry. So that's where you really have to get to know your plants by the weight of their pot.
Okay.
When the pot is heavy, you don't water. If the pot feels light, you should water. And you can't go by timing. I mean, in some houses where the humidity is set just right in the wintertime when plants aren't using a lot of water, they can go a month. And if the pot is still heavy, go by that. Go by the density of that soil. But in some houses, it's not even the plant. The air itself is sucking the water out of that soil. To try to reach some sort of stasis, and you may have to water every day or every other day. But to get rid of the spider mites, you want to spray, you want to mist that water directly onto the leaves of the plant every morning.
Okay, that's so good to know. So hopefully I'll get some lemons.
Yes, and read up on indoor citrus care. They're unusual plants. They need a moister soil than a lot of house plants. They do need a little bit more food than most house plants. But start with the misting, and that'll get rid of the spider mites and make the plants a lot happier, because the mites will suck the energy out of that plant.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, good luck.
Okay, thanks.
1-888-346-9499. Jim, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Glad to be on your show.
Oh, glad to have you, Jim. Where are you?
I'm Milton, Delaware.
Did you say Milton, Delaware?
Yes, that is correct.
All right. What can we do for Jim from Milton, Delaware?
I built a new house a couple of years ago, and both for my house and for our association, I heard from your show the black mulch I put down has a lot of bad consequences to it. And I'm entertaining a question around the rubberized mulch now, and my question around that is the concern, what are your concerns or pros or cons, and the possibility of leaching, chemical leaching from the byproduct of the tire?
Well, when you say you put down black mulch, does that mean you bought some type of wood that had been chipped and dyed black?
That's correct.
Yeah. And what is the siding of your house made of?
It's vinyl.
And I'm shocked. You mean you haven't had the little black dots showing up on it yet?
Well, I clean it. I have to clean it. So.
Oh, okay. So you already have artillery fungus spores trying to colonize your house.
That's correct.
Yes, and you know that that's coming from the wood.
I learn from your show. I listen to it as often as I can. I've heard you say the negative things that go with that. So.
Right. Wood mulch is very bad to be used too deeply. If you use it deeper than 2 or 3 inches, it prevents rainwater from getting through. It can suck the nitrogen out of the soil and harm plants. It can kill a plant if it touches the plant. But what most people experience are the nuisance molds, either the artillery fungus spores staining the side of their house, or they get all these kind of weird mushrooms and fungus growing up out of the mulch. I fear that the rubber mulch is probably the only thing that's worse. Now, you realize that rubber mulch is chipped up old car tires.
Yes, sir.
It seems like any time we have a waste disposal problem in America, somebody stands up and says, I bet we can get gardeners to actually pay for this stuff. And the rubber mulch is a prime example. The wood mulch showed up in such abundance a couple of decades ago when landfills stopped accepting wood waste. And now the rubber mulch showed up when tires became a huge problem. Three problems. The rubber that's used to make tires is loaded with zinc, and zinc can be very toxic to plants in these kind of amounts. So not only does it leach the petroleum products and any chemicals it picked up in its years of operation as a tire, but it's putting a lot of metals in the ground. Second, and what people don't realize until they have this stuff for a season, when this rubber mulch heats up in July and August, it smells like hot rubber. And it turns out it is a fire hazard. People have sent me these reports from all around the country of rubber mulch spontaneously bursting into flame when people layered it on a little too heavily, or when the moisture content just got right in the center, or some idiot threw a cigarette into it. And unfortunately, there have been a lot of people who've used rubber mulch around their home and come home to find that they no longer have a home.
Wow.
So if you want mulch to keep down weeds and to retain soil moisture, or just to have a decorative look around your house, the absolute best choice is black yard waste compost. And I know the state of Delaware has a lot of municipalities that have active composting programs. And I know it seems counterintuitive, but in a study done at 3 separate universities in conjunction with each other, Iowa State University, Ohio State University, and the University of Kentucky, 2 inches of black yard waste compost suppressed weeds just as well as 2 inches of shredded, dyed wood mulch. So you don't give up anything. And then the other good mulches are pine straw. Once you get down further south, you don't see wood mulch for sale in garden centers. People mulch with pine straw. They absolutely love it. And if you can find them, the seed, hull, and nut mulches. Down south, pecan hull mulch is a huge deal. People love it. It lasts longer than wood mulch. It looks great. But unfortunately, rubber mulch is somebody trying to dump their toxic waste problem on you and get you to pay for it. And wood mulch only evolved because people couldn't landfill it anymore. It's really not a good mulch horticulturally or for houses.
That's excellent news. I really appreciate the information there.
If you do mulch with compost, then I urge you to put ornamental plantings all around, because that compost will not only prevent weeds, it'll feed and care for your plants. You won't have to do anything but sit back and look brilliant.
Well, I like to do that, so I use any edge I can get there, so that's good to know.
All right. Well, good luck, Jim.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Take care, sir. All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Does warm winter weather equal early crabgrass? Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden. We got lots of questions this week.
We really did, Mike. I'm going to start with Chris in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. He writes, does the crazy warm winter weather we've been experiencing affect the long-standing advice to watch for local forsythia to bloom before applying corn gluten meal to prevent crabgrass? What if I apply it now? And Mary in Fairfax, Virginia writes, have we missed the best timing to apply the corn gluten, or have the forsythia missed nature's call this year due to the strange weather? And finally, Jeff from Washington, D.C. writes, this will be the third year I've used corn gluten on my lawn, and the results have been great. In the past, you have advised us to spread the product when forsythia and eastern red buds are in bloom. This year is a little crazy, and some of the forsythia in my neighborhood is already blooming. Do you think crabgrass germination will also be early, or should I wait for the red buds? Mike, clearly this is a hot topic, so what do you think?
Well, the unnaturally warm winter weather experienced by many areas of the country has given a record number of gardeners and lawn owners out there a severe case of the spielkes, especially where timing issues are concerned. But it seems that those of us in USDA growing zone 7 and lower are still in a waiting game when it comes to crabgrass prevention timing, even in some cases if blooms are showing on local forsythia already. Fueled by a plethora of emails with crabgrass or corn gluten in the subject line, I decided to ask the man who pioneered the use of corn gluten as a natural pre-emergent herbicide, Iowa State University turf grass expert Dr. Nick Christians, exactly how a warm winter might affect the timing of this natural pre-emergent weed and feed that, like all pre-emergents, chemical or organic, must be applied before weed seeds sprout to have the desired effect. Nick was thrilled to have the chance to modify and expand upon his original apply corn gluten when the forsythia blooms advice, because he explained university horticulturalists have been telling him that different named varieties of forsythia can have very different bloom times, with the earliest flowering varieties popping close to 6 weeks before a late bloomer. So that makes the eastern red bud, a much less diverse specimen, a better visual cue. But an even better tactic, stresses Nick, is to move from potentially fickle flowers to the world of measurable science. Insert the probe of a simple soil thermometer 4 inches below the soil line and apply your crabgrass to feeding corn when the thermometer reads 55 degrees. Because while the ideal time to apply corn gluten may generally be when the local forsythia and red buds bloom, it is always when the soil temperature reaches 55 degrees Fahrenheit, 4 inches down. And although he hates to try and guess at exact dates, Nick was coaxed into estimating that even with our warm winter, the soil temperature should begin to reach that number around April 1st in the D.C. area and around tax time in the greater Philadelphia area. But as we always stress, inner city soils warm up much earlier than ones out in the suburbs, and elevation and microclimates can make for a high degree of variability even inside the boundaries of the same general neighborhood. So buy a soil thermometer and stop guessing. Simple mechanical ones that look a lot like a meat thermometer sell for under $20, or spend a little more and get one that'll also measure the heat of your compost pile. Note, no matter what, it's always better to apply a pre-emergent a little early than a little late. Corn gluten has about a 6-week window of effectiveness, and all pre-emergents are useless on seeds that have already germinated. Oh, and to follow the new legal guidelines designed to protect the Chesapeake Bay from nitrogen pollution, folks near that national treasure and other fragile waterways should apply no more than 10 pounds of corn gluten per 1,000 square feet of turf. Yes, I have advised using up to 20 pounds in the past, but as Maryland Turfgrass Council President Vernon Cooper correctly explains in an open letter he posted to me recently, that amount is now technically illegal, as it would exceed the new limits of 9 pounds of nitrogen per single application. I am happy to so modify my advice. I know you'd all come visit me on Sundays, but I look terrible in stripes. Oh, and one final note from Nick. People who report crabgrass appearing very early in the season are probably looking at knotweed, which Nick explains is common in lawns whose soil has become heavily compacted over time. Pulling plugs out of that overly dense soil with a machine called a core aerator in the early fall will open things up and allow the grass to outcompete this weed. Well, that sure was an authoritative answer about the timing of corn gluten application, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review this week's edition, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to make my corn gluten-free if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. You can also listen to this show there, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our webmasters are Baneful Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. The never-crabby Alexis Landis produces and co-edits You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our production assistant, Amanda No Relation McGrath, is rarely crabby. Next on the crabbiness scale, we find our esteemed editor, Al Banks. I'm king of the crabs, Mike McGrath, and I'll kvetch my way back to see you next week. What? You call this a microphone? It looks like a tin can with a string you got hanging in here. And this computer, this thing is so old, its mouse is hunchback. Why, I tell you. What does it take to grow really sweet carrots? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal the path to crunchy, sugary roots. Plus your fabulous phone calls.
Laburnum, ladybugs, laurel, lavender. Like it? Love it? Mike helps us learn the lingo that leads to a lavish garden. Saturday mornings at 11 on You Bet Your Garden, here on WHYY.